I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
Our founding fathers knew that freedom of the press is one of the basic tenets of democracy, and to ensure our right to a free flow of information, they protected the press in the Bill of Rights, the only industry afforded this luxury. Yet today, is the press really free? Dr. Carl Jensen of the California State University Sonoma decided to look into this issue over 25 years ago.
Classes in the media, and I was teaching a class, Sociology of Media. One of the problems I had in that class was that I never could explain satisfactorily to the students or to myself how it could be that Richard Nixon won election to the presidency in fall of 1972 by a landslide vote nearly 5 months after the biggest political burglary crime in history. So I started looking into that. I mean, where were the media? What happened there? And I discovered that Watergate was not an issue in 1972. I mean, I think now most of us look back and we say, well, Watergate was a big issue in 72. It wasn't. It was a non-issue. I found stories about Watergate in the alternative media, but not in the mass media. That was the genesis of the project. So then I started looking at the alternative media and I discovered, whoa, all kinds of stories I hadn't seen in the mass media. And I thought, wow, there's something strange going on there. And so the more I looked into it, the more I discovered that, and that was the basis and genesis of Project Censor.
On this edition of Parallax Views. In the past, the free press was often referred to as the Fourth Estate, a people's watchdog, tasked with the responsibility of exposing corruption and malfeasance on the part of the powerful. Within this framework, the free press was seen as necessary and vital to the functioning of a healthy democracy. But what happens when the very interests this free press is meant to keep in check take hold of the Fourth Estate? Out of that, another question arises. Quisa custodiet ipsos custodessa? Who watches the watchers? One answer is the non-profit media watchdog organization Project Censored. Prior to this introduction, you heard an excerpt from the 1998 Martin Sheen narrated documentary, Project Censored, Is the Press Really Free? Featuring the organization's founder, Sonoma State University professor, Dr. Carl Jensen. Founded in 1976 by Dr. Jensen as a response to the press failures around Watergate, Project Censored aims to, quote, educate students and the public about the importance of a truly free press for democratic self-government. For over 40 years, Project Censored has sought to shine a much-needed light on issues related to censorship, junk food news, news abuse, and critical media literacy. In addition to hosting a weekly public affairs program and producing documentary films related to these important matters, Project Censored also publishes an annual yearbook which attempts to collate the top censored news stories and media analysis of the past year. Joining us to discuss the latest yearbook in this long-running series, Censored 2020, Through the Looking Glass, is Andy Lee Roth, Associate Director of Project Censored and Coordinator of the project's Validated Independent News Program. In this conversation, Andy and I discuss not only some of the top stories highlighted in Censored 2020, but also the Alice in Wonderland Through the Looking Glass quality of media discourse in a digital age fraught with concerns over the phenomena of fake news. And as an added bonus, Andy graciously offered to stay a bit overtime to discuss the recent collapse of Deadspin and Splinter under GO Media Group, and what it may mean for the future of journalists and the media ecosystem in America today. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. Now, why don't we dive right into the conversation with Andy Lee Roth, Associate Director of Project Censored, on the Censored 2020 yearbook, Through the Looking Glass. Welcome to Parallax Views. It's been a long time coming. Andy Lee Roth, Associate Director of Project Censored, and also the coordinator of Project Censored's Validated Independent News Program, and the co-author with Mickey Huff, a favorite friend of the show, of the Censored 2020 Through the Looking Glass annual Project Censored news book out now from Seven Stories Press. In that book, folks, you're going to hear you're going to read about the top 25 censored news stories, and you'll hear about a few of them on this episode today. How are you doing, Andy?
I'm doing well, JG. It's a pleasure to join you on Parallax Views.
So, Andy, maybe for listeners, I always assume I have new listeners, so maybe for listeners that are unfamiliar, that haven't heard Mickey talk about Project Censored on my podcast before, maybe you could just really briefly fill my listeners who are unfamiliar in on what Project Censored is.
Yeah, I think about Project Censored having kind of like the two wings of a bird. A bird won't fly if it has just one wing, and so there's a critical wing and an affirmative wing to the project as I conceive of it. The critical wing is that Project Censored, since it was established in 1976 by Dr. Carl Jensen at Sonoma State University, since 1976, Project Censored has consistently been calling out the corporate news media when they fail to provide us the kind of news and information that we need in order to be engaged community members and active citizens. So that's the critical dimension, critiquing the corporate media for its blind spots, for its third rail topics that it refuses to address, and indeed for its, as we'll get into today, its kind of funhouse mirror representation of the world. The other side of the project is affirmative. The other aspect of the project is affirmative. And by affirmative, I mean we consistently celebrate the good work, and I mean that in a non-trivial sense, Good work meaning both work of the highest quality, but also work that serves the public good. The good work of independent journalists and independent news outlets who bring us the stories, who inform us about the stories that the corporate media leave us either ignorant or confused about. And I think of independent news media as making good on the directive of the late, great Walter Lippmann, one of the most important journalists and public figures of the early 20th century, who in a book called Liberty in the News advised journalists to tell the truth and shame the devil. And I think a lot of the content of Censored 2020 would, if I may be so brash, please Walter Lippmann, were he to be alive to read it today, that we're calling out devils and shaming them, but we're also at the same time, as I say, not just critical, but also affirmative. We're pointing people towards sources of constructive journalism and solutions journalism. So there are these two wings. And organizationally, as I mentioned, established at in 1976 at Sonoma State University.
And also, I want to add, it's been praised in the past by people like I believe Noam Chomsky praised it. I believe Walter Cronkite was a supporter. I mean, today we have supporters like Abby Martin. So it has gotten a lot of great buzz over the years.
Yeah. I mean, we have blurbs in the book every year from people. Like, we have one that we run every year. The late Howard Zinn referred to what the project was doing as an important contribution, systematically exposing censored stories. I.F. Stone called the project one of the most significant media research projects in the country. On and on it goes. You know, Noam Chomsky refers to the project as a crucial contribution to hope for a more just and democratic society. So we've come a long way from a single class of students at Sonoma State when Carl founded the project back in 1976. And a crucial development, and this is at the heart of what I do with Project Censored, a crucial development was around 2009-2010. Peter Phillips, who some of your listeners will know as the author of Giants, the book about the transnationalist capitalist class, Peter Phillips, who was the director of Project Censored at the time, and Mickey Huff, who's the current director, undertook a bold and I think what has been entirely successful shift to basically delocate the project. The project still has strong roots at Sonoma State University in California, but we now have a network of in any given year, a network of somewhere between one and two dozen college and university campuses across the country where students and faculty are identifying, researching, vetting independent news stories on what are otherwise underreported, if not outright invisible news topics. So this year, every year we put out a book. Every year, one of the features of that book is a list of the 25 most important but underreported independent news stories. And this year, to give you some idea of what I'm talking about when I talk about kind of the project as a networked news commons, this year some 283 students 24 faculty mentors from 15 different college and university campuses contributed to researching the several hundred news stories, independent news stories that we reviewed and vetted this year that became the pool from which this year's top 25 list appears. So when we're talking about the project, there's both kind of the big picture. We critique the corporate media when they fail to do what they need to do, what they ought to do to fulfill their you know, much cherished image as the fourth estate and so forth and so on. And we affirm and try to encourage public support for the really high quality independent news that is available if you just look for it. And the way we do that is through things like our annual book. The project has a weekly radio show that originates from KPFA in Berkeley, the flagship station of the historic Pacifica network of radio stations. We have a documentary film out and another one on the way that Abby Martin actually has helped us put together. The new one is on fake news. The one that's out now is called Project Censored, the movie ending the reign of junk food news. That was made by Christopher Oscar and Doug Hecker. And Doug Hecker is actually a student alum of the project. So we've got multiple kind of projects within the project, all of which are aimed at this basic idea of bolstering public support for independent media, increasing the public's awareness of important but underreported news stories, and ultimately kind of trying to be a vehicle for greater critical media literacy, because we believe that that's a crucial kind of skill for community members and democratic and community members and citizens in a democracy to have.
Well, you know, before we dive more into the contents of the book, and I always talk about this with Mickey, because I always get annoyed whenever you make criticism of how the media is structured in America. People immediately jump to that mentality of, oh, you're saying it's a conspiracy of five guys in a smoky room, you know, and they show someone the footage of the Kennedy assassination from another angle, as Bill Hicks would say. I don't think that's what media criticism is, though. I mean, I think we can talk about conspiratorial sort of maneuverings made by different agencies, both private and within the government. But I think when we're talking about media criticism, this is not necessarily something related to conspiracy theories.
No, not at all. I mean, I think when you talk about conspiracy, by definition, a conspiracy is something that is done or at least attempted in secrecy. And if we're talking about things like what my academic colleagues would refer to as the political economy of the news media, or what I like to think of as the kind of the media landscape or the media ecology, it's a well-known fact, and it is a matter of fact, that in the United States, 90% of the media that we consume, and by media here I mean not only news media in the form of newspapers and broadcast news shows and so forth and so on, but all the media that we consume. So this is movies, television, books, my favorite pop music, et cetera, et cetera. 90% of that media content is produced and controlled by six major corporations, right? And so that's not a conspiracy theory. That's a matter of fact. And that's not my political opinion shaping that fact. That is, you know, a verifiable empirical claim about the world, about the way that most media content is produced in a corporate framework in what is, you know, a society driven by capitalist pressures to make profits at the expense of almost everything else.
Well, you know, it's interesting too, because a lot of people that haven't read, say, the classic Chomsky book, Manufacturing Consent. When I mention that to younger people, they're like, oh, that sounds, you know, like, they'll even say, like, oh, that sounds like conspiracy theory, manufacturing consent. But I'm pretty sure that Walter Lippmann was the first one to use that term,
yes.
Manufacturing consent.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that term manufactured consent is something that Walter Lippmann wrote about in that book, Liberty and the News, in 1920. And that phrase is kind of was obviously given a much wider kind of currency by Ed Herman and Noam Chomsky when they produced Manufacturing Consent. But the roots of that idea are deep. And the consolidation that is at the heart of that, and the kind of, you know, the other person I think of is besides Herman and Chomsky is the late Ben Bagdikian on his book Media Monopoly. And whenever Bagdikian spoke in public and in much of his writing, he was constantly reminding people of the simple point that media power is political power, right? And so if we're talking about a society that is rent by inequalities and therefore has all the social structural instability of a hierarchy where those at the top are a small minority, but they control a great amount of resources, right? There's always going to be a struggle for maintaining control. And, you don't need to be an Ed Herman or a Ben Bagdikian or a Noam Chomsky to understand that in today's world, right, control of the media or a place, a footing, standing in the media is a form of cultural power, right? It's a form of influence that can be converted to other forms of power.
And before we really dive into the book, the last thing I wanted to mention, because I don't think I've covered it with Mickey before, but you know, one of the main features of each annual edition of Project Censored's book is the top 25 censored news stories. And I was wondering if you could get into how these news stories are vetted and collected and then presented in this book.
Yeah, I would love to do that because it goes to the heart of what I do as the coordinator of this campus affiliates program that links together. So the students and faculty at these dozens of campuses across the country. So as I suggest, it's a kind of a year-long process. It's a year-long process that involves literally hundreds and hundreds of people. It starts in classrooms across the country where there's a professor who is connected to Project Censored somehow, and they send their students out on an assignment that is to find an independent news story on a topic of interest to them, to research that story, especially for the quality and reliability of the reporting, but also for whether that story has been covered at all in the corporate news media. And if so, to compare and contrast the independent news stories coverage of the topic with the corporate coverage of the topic. And those stories then get written up as small synopses. They're brief intentionally, not because we don't think the students can't write well enough to write a longer one. But part of the idea of the validated independent news program is that a lot of people in the general public feel like, oh, I just don't have the time to keep up with all the news that's out there, right? It's what the founder, Carl Jensen, the founder of our project, Carl Jensen, referred to as news inflation. There seems to be more and more of it, but it's worth less and less. So the idea is that these validated independent news summaries are not only informing you about stories that are important but underreported, but they're also doing so in about the time it takes to, I don't know what, you know, wait for your cup of coffee to brew. They're short summaries. The summaries are linked. So, and they're all available, I should say, they're all available. These validated independent news stories that I'm talking about are posted on the Project Censored website, projectcensored.org. So you can go there and see the latest stories that we're tracking. Once the stories are posted on the website, oh, and when they are posted, there's the brief summary I was just describing. There then are also the references back to the original journalistic reporting on which the Project Censored summary is based, with live links so that you can go back if you're interested and want to dig deeper. It's very easy to trace back from the Project Censored site to whatever the independent news outlet is tracking that particular story. We also, on those validated independent news web pages for each article, list who the student researcher was and who the faculty evaluator was. And without going too far down this pathway, I can just say that as a teacher in the classes where I do this exercise with my students, the students are highly motivated by the idea that they're working on an assignment that might have relevance beyond the classroom itself, beyond the kind of the boundaries of their campus. I think a lot of the students that I encounter, for example, in my introduction to sociology classes, are very hungry to be involved in something bigger than themselves and something that, you know, quote, makes a difference. And the assignment is motivating for them in that way, because if they do a good job and they have a story that's got some legs to it, they'll see their stuff up on the website, which reaches a global audience. And if their story really gets going, it might end up in the top 25 list published in the book. So how does that happen? How does a story make it from being a validated independent news story on the Project Censored website to being in the top 25. This is where the next kind of phase of this year-long process that I'm describing comes in. Around spring of every year, we vote on the stories, and every faculty member and student who's been involved in the process will cast their votes. And we whittle the 200 to 300 stories down to a pool of about 30 or so. And we send those 30 stories along to the project's esteemed panel of judges who are media experts, news professionals themselves. Nicholas Johnson, one of our judges who served for a long time, was a former FCC commissioner. The judges ultimately cast their votes to rank order the top 25 and to give us advice on those stories in terms of maybe they have been aware of other aspects of that story. So at the end of the cycle, we come out with kind of the very cream at the top is this list of 25 stories from the past year that are important, high quality, but underreported or distorted in the corporate news media.
Now, it's kind of interesting because I believe this edition of Project Censored, it took me by surprise because I think it starts out a little bit differently. It starts out with a poem. and I don't know if that was in other editions, if you guys start out with a poem, but I wanted to highlight this poem for my listeners, if we could do that briefly here.
Yeah, it is a little unusual. You're right, JG. But this poem was so good that when I brought it to Mickey, I said, let's include this. This is a poem called Finding Strength in Community by Gilda L. Ochoa, who is a professor of Chicana Latina studies at Pomona College in Southern California. Most of the time, Gilda writes scholarly books on topics like academic profiling and how Latinos and Asian Americans fare in the so-called achievement gap. And she's won awards, scholarly awards for those books as a sociologist and an activist. But more recently, Gilda's been turning to poetry as a way to explore some of these ideas and to get these ideas out to a wider audience. I went to graduate school at UCLA in sociology with Gilda, and so she's a longtime dear friend of mine and an inspiration to me in so many ways as someone who combines rigorous scholarship and truly committed grassroots community activism. So this is Finding Strength in Community by Gilda L. Ochoa. Thinking of teachers, regardless of whether they carry that name, inside our schools and far away from those rooms, who every day see our full humanity, show their own vulnerability, name the realities of inequality, unmask erased histories, deconstruct prevailing ideologies, build spaces showing another way, inspiring us to continue another day. And when I saw that poem the first time, I just thought that's what we're trying to do with these censored yearbooks and with all the things that Project Censored does in the classroom, through the radio show, across the documentary movies, right? We're naming the realities of inequality. We're attempting to unmask these erased histories. We're deconstructing the prevailing ideologies, all with the aim of trying to show that there's another and better way possible than the version that we find ourselves in so much of the day now.
Well, it's interesting because that version we find ourselves in, I kind of like where you guys have gone with it. I believe last year's was sort of a War of the Worlds influenced sort of theme with the cover.
Yeah.
This year, though, it's a little bit different. It's Through the Looking Glass, a little bit of Alice in Wonderland themes, motifs, really great cover art as usual in this edition of Project Censored. Maybe you could tell my listeners a little bit about why you and Mickey chose that sort of Alice in Wonderland Through the Looking Glass motif.
JG, I don't know if it comes over the airwaves, but I'm smiling as you're saying that because we had so much fun with this this theme this year. And we have to give a shout out here to our fantastic editor at Seven Stories Press, Michael Tinser, who actually, it was a conversation, Mickey, Mickey, Michael and I had and we were talking about something, and Michael just off the cuff said, yeah, Through the Looking Glass, man. And we were like, boom, that's it. That's our theme. And we liked it a lot because this is the Censored 2020 yearbook. So there's a couple, you know, the idea of a looking glass is something that might help clarify your vision. So we were playing with these ideas of 2020 vision, right? Seeing things clearly. But of course, Through the Looking Glass, the Alice in Wonderland kind of Lewis Carroll note imagery there is all about distortion and inversion and crazy stuff. And if I could, I think I might just read you a little bit from Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass, a couple of lines. So from poetry to literature here. The queen in Through the Looking Glass is berating Alice. She's already explained to Alice that Alice is simply not trying hard enough when it comes to believing impossible things, that Alice should just take a deep breath, shut her eyes and believe impossible things. Alice says, there's no use trying. You can't believe impossible things. And the queen says, well, you just haven't had enough practice. So this kind of crazy, illogical conversation continues on with the queen explaining to Alice that they can't have jam with their tea today because the rule is jam tomorrow, jam yesterday, but never jam today. And Alice, again, refusing to kind of accept the queen's twisted logic, says, but it must come sometimes to jam today, Alice objected. And the queen says, no, it can't. It's jam every other day, and today isn't any other day, you know. And Alice says, I don't understand. It's dreadfully confusing. And Mickey and I kind of riff on that theme of, like, with the corporate news, substitute real news for jam, and with the corporate news, you get a kind of twisted queen logic, right? A stark rendering of how the corporate news on a regular basis fail to provide us the news we need. But, you know, also on a daily basis, if you look elsewhere, the best independent journalists and news outlets make sure that the jam, in this case, the jam is fact-based news that serves the public interest, that tells the truth and shames the devil, right? Is available to those who have an appetite for it. So yeah, we had fun riffing on those ideas. And then Anson Stevens Bolin, who is just an amazing artist, and people who haven't seen his work other than these covers ought to know that, yeah, he goes to town doing covers for us. And I think he had a lot of fun doing the Alice in Wonderland themes that for this year's book. But people should check out Anson Stevens Bolin's work on online if you do a search on his name, and you'll find all kinds of amazing stuff. He's from Santa Fe, New Mexico. And yeah, so the cover he gave us this year is, I think, on a whole nother level. And it's and as we always, you know, Mickey and I have fun quipping with Anson doing the artwork for us. We're happy to have our book judged by its cover.
Well, you know, I think the Alice in Wonderland motif works very well for the current situation we find ourselves in, because, you know, if I, for instance, criticize corporate media outlets, if I criticize MSNBC, I will have people say to me, well, that's Republican propaganda. And then if I criticize, say, Breitbart, I'll get called a leftist propagandist. And I mean, admittedly, my politics are very much to the left. I don't hide that. But, you know, this idea that, you know, it's either us or them. It's either you're with the corporate media and the Democrats, or you're, you know, a right winger, and vice versa. It's mind boggling to me. And right now we have this fake news issue. And I think there are a lot of websites pushing phony baloney news and nonsense and sensationalism. And at the same time, we have, you know, places like Facebook wanting to decide what the news is, what actually constitutes the news. And there's some people that are all for that. You know, let's let the experts decide, you know, how we curate our news. And I just think to myself, well, that could be a problem in and of itself. And I feel like we have to fight both sides on this, the fake news and the people who offer a solution that may actually end up being censorship.
That's right. I mean, so let me address both points of that question. On one hand, we have the corporate media and what we talk about in this year's Censored Yearbook as the kind of the looking glass logic of the corporate media, where imaginary threats outweigh real existential crises, where privacy is sort of an unaffordable luxury, where, you know, as we've been riffing here right now, you know, manufactured consent is the name of the game, right? So we have all this kind of looking glass logic imagery, right? Things are inverted, right? The magic mirrors of clickbait driven reporting and hot takes 24/7 and social media feeds that are governed by these secret algorithms, and then the would be warriors against the threat of fake news. The way I think about that, so shifting then to the second point about kind of fake news and the moral panic over fake news, is that really, like, fake news is a kind of the proverbial tip of the iceberg. And maybe the good thing about concern over fake news is it's gotten people thinking about these issues in a way that creates an opportunity for Project Censored and outlets and people like Project Censored to draw the public's attention to the big mass that's beneath the above the surface tip of fake news. So I think the real issue here is fake news is the tip of the iceberg, the massive bulk of which is so-called news that's basically a vehicle for PR and propaganda of various sorts. But yes, I mean, it's going back to notions of control. And so there's all kinds of stuff going on, and we can dive into, we can go down, to use the other Lewis Carroll metaphor, we can dive down the rabbit hole of this for a little bit now and talk about, you know, just headlines from a week or two ago, the announcement of Facebook News a couple of weeks ago, the Google News Initiative, which is a little older, and all of these efforts by what are now not traditional corporate news media outlets, but the latest cutting edge corporate media platforms to basically control the flow of information and opinion. And so in many ways, it's a continuation of the dynamics identified by the Herman and Chomsky propaganda model in manufacturing consent. But there also are new twists and variations on these old themes that deserve consideration in their own right.
Yeah, and there's a lot of alternative news websites that have already been affected by this. I mean, immediately after Trump won the election in 2016. I forget that it was called Prop something.
Proper not.
They were listing all these news websites as being Russian propaganda, and they were even listing websites like Counterpunch. And I'm pretty friendly with the people at Counterpunch, and Counterpunch has published things that will get into Russian malfeasances, whether in the elections or not in the elections. And yet, you know, they're labeling Counterpunch as fake news, and it's going to have real dire consequences, in my view, when you go after alternative media.
Mm-hmm. We have several. I would say the Censored 2020 book has several features that speak directly to these concerns. One is our number two story this year on our top 25 chapter is about how Facebook has been partnering with a variety of think tanks, including most prominently the the Atlantic Council, to kind of combat fake news, right? And under the guise of combating fake news, the Atlantic Council, which is funded by things like the Department of State, the U.S. Army, the U.S. Navy, the U.S. Air Force, and a whole bunch of major multinational corporations, right? Including many of the big oil companies, petro companies, global asset management firms and banks, military contractors, and indeed, you know, several dozen foreign countries, right? So if we talk about, for instance, the Atlantic Council then influencing Facebook's thinking on what to do about fake news, we have what Adam Johnson at FAIR has referred to as a fairly narrow kind of conception of what the U.S. role in the world ought to be. Quoting here from a report by Johnson at FAIR about this story, the idea being that although there is a diversity of opinion, it's in a very, and now I'm quoting directly, it's a very limited pro-Western ideological framework, a framework that debates how much and where U.S. military and soft power influence should be wielded, not if it should in the first place. So on one hand, we have, Facebook partnerships with big think tanks like the Atlantic Council. And it's important to point out here these, when you say think tank, I think the intended kind of image is, a kind of august institution where there is objective analysis of pressing social and political problems. But again, like when you look at who the funders of the Atlantic Council are, quickly the veneer washes away. And so, you can look at the names of various think tanks like the Heritage Foundation and so forth. They all sound kind of august. And, but when you look at the funding, then you realize like every one of these on the left and on the right, are ideologically driven in some way. And that's important to keep in mind. The other thing that we have that speaks, I think, to this notion of, how social media giants like media giants like Google and Facebook and others are working to silence alternative news outlets and reestablish corporate news dominance is a fantastic chapter called Fake News, the Trojan Horse for Silencing Alternative News and Reestablishing Corporate News Dominance by Emil Marmol and Lee Major. And they go into detail, and I will not be able to, even if we took a whole hour, do justice to the full import of their chapter. But just some of the examples of that they give. Back in October of 2018, many people will remember that Facebook and Twitter deplatformed roughly 800 or so accounts on a single day. It was, described by many independent news outlets as a purge. The purged entities included things like Anti-Media, Cop Block, Countercurrent News, Filming Cops, the Free Thought Project, Police the Police, an RT America correspondent. Earlier in the month, Twitter had banned the posting of hacked materials on its site, which meant that materials brought to the public's attention by whistleblowers could not be posted on Twitter. The list goes on and on. Twitter and Facebook have repeatedly suspended respected Venezuelan news outlets. Those sites have often been reinstated after there's been public outcry. We know that Facebook, in coordination with the governments of Israel and the U.S., regularly shuts down the accounts of prominent Palestinian political parties, activists, and news outlets. And again, the list goes on and on. I'm just reading a few of the, I guess, lowlights are what they would be, if you will, not highlights. A few lowlights from Emil Marmol and Lee Major's chapter. And so the idea is that this is a full out effort by corporate entities to, in this case, Google and Facebook and others, partnering up with kind of legacy news media outlets to try to throttle alternative voices and independent voices, right? The corporate news conglomerates, Marmol and Major, right, are working diligently to extinguish alternative and independent news as well as certain international news sources' presence online, right? And they need to do that because in the minds of economic and political elites, the problem with these alternative, independent, and certain foreign news sources is that, again, in Marmol and Major's words, they cover issues such as class struggle, inequality, racism, environmental degradation, collapse, democratic and civil liberty shortcomings, brutality and murder committed by state actors, both domestically and abroad, illegal wars, war crimes, illegal surveillance, corporate and political malfeasance in all its forms, right? So insofar as alternative news media are serving to discredit, to make illegitimate the very foundations on which the establishment authority is resting, it's no surprise that representatives of the establishment authority, those who have vested interests in the status quo, are doing what they can to try to throttle these sources, these outlets.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I wanted to maybe briefly cover the effect of algorithms on how we get our news, because I just wonder, like, well, how is what news we're getting, how is it being prioritized? And not only that, but it seems like everyone is just in their own different silo at this point. You know, there's people that will read, Breitbart, and they won't read anything else. Or there's people that will only read The Guardian and not anything else. Or people that read The New York Times and nothing else. And it just seems like a whole mess of a situation we find ourselves in.
Yeah, I think on that second point about the, you know, the kind of self-imposed boundaries, I think in terms of food metaphors, and, you know, although say, I don't know what edamame soybeans may be healthy for me, if I try to eat only edamame soybeans for the next month, my body, there will be negative consequences for my body, even though edamame soybeans themselves are not unhealthy, right? We need a diversity of food types in our diet for our body to be healthy. And I believe it's the same thing with news. We need a diversity of news sources to be truly well-informed and engaged. So that's, I think, on the consumer side, on the public side. But the other issue you mentioned that's so important is that, when we sit down at the table, what's served up for us is the result of decisions made by various powers that be. And when we have these powerful, some of the most powerful kind of human organizations in the history of the world controlling the flow of information through algorithms, then what's, in effect, what's for dinner is potentially pretty thin gruel. I'll say a few things about this focused on LGBTQ, coverage of LGBTQ issues for a moment. Stuff I know about from work with my colleague April Anderson, who's...
You have a whole report on this subject, by the way, for my listeners, in Censored 2020. It's a whole chapter.
Yeah. So April and I have a chapter in the book, but what I'm about to describe now is stuff that we're interested in having finished that chapter. That chapter is about newspaper news coverage, but what April has got us on now is how, for instance, on global media platforms, LGBTQ related keywords and content are being blacklisted in the name of brand safety. Google's search algorithms are prioritizing alt-right content and alt and anti-gay news sites. YouTube has been demonetizing content creators whose channels are focused on LGBT issues. TikTok has local moderation guidelines that are work inadvertently, perhaps, but they nonetheless work to censor pro-LGBT content. And that's just to think about, some of these platforms in terms of LGBT-related content. So we know that these algorithms do. My field by training is sociology, and some of the classic studies that you first encounter when you read sociology of news research are studies that were done back in the early 20th century about so-called gatekeeping. And the idea at the time was that, well, a local newspaper editor could act as a, quote, gatekeeper, letting some stories that he liked through the gate while blocking others at the gate so that they never make it into the newspaper. And I think what we've got now is sort of the modern, the digital 21st century version of gatekeeping revolves around the idea not of the editor at the small town paper, but the algorithms of these giant, global media organizations, where the algorithms are always proprietary, meaning that, you know, Google will not disclose the ways that its algorithm works because that's considered a, you know, a industry secret. So we know that they work. We know from great research by independent news outlets, we can sometimes get glimpses of how these algorithms work and the impacts that they have. But their power is massive, and this is something that I think falls under the rubric of what we talk about when we talk about critical media literacy, is understanding to the best that we can how when you do a Google search, you will get certain kinds of returns on whatever you search for based on the algorithms that Google uses, that it's using. And if you just want to do a simple kind of, you can do it at home and see the difference for yourself, do a Google search on the topic of your choice. You could do for fun, you could say, let's do the arrest of Max Blumenthal, the independent journalist. Do a search on that on Google, and then do a search of that on DuckDuckGo and see what the differences look like. What you'll be seeing are differences between Google and DuckDuckGo that are the product of those algorithms and how those algorithms are designed to have a variety of things float to the top and other things be put in the equivalent of the kind of, you know, cement shoes that the mob bosses used to, you know, toss unwanted, inconvenient people into the Hudson River or something.
Is there anything else you would like to say about that specific report we mentioned? Let me see if I can find it.
Chapter 7,
Stonewalled, Establishment Media's Silence on the Trump Administration Crusade Against LGBTQ People.
Yes. So I can give just the quick kind of 30-second summary of what we're doing in that chapter, and then people can go to Censored 2020 and learn about it in much more detail. April and I were basically looking at news coverage of important LGBT issues in four major corporate newspapers: the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the Los Angeles Times, and the New York Times, and then comparing that coverage with independent news coverage. And I can just highlight very quickly a couple key findings. One is that we found that corporate news, yes, LGBT issues are featured prominently in contemporary newspaper coverage, corporate news coverage. But that coverage during the time we studied, which was between January of 2016 and November of 2018, a 35-month period that kind of spans the run-up to the 2016 presidential election through the midterm congressional elections of 2018. During that period, what we found was, yes, there was a fair amount of coverage of LGBT issues in those four big corporate newspapers, but most of that coverage focused on two issues. One was Trump's proposed ban on military service for transgender people. And the other was coverage of what corporate news media often refer to as so-called bathroom bills, but are really local and state ordinances to prevent discrimination against people who are not gender conforming, who identify in one way or another as transgender. But the term bathroom bills, which was introduced by conservative advocates to try to kind of villainize transgender people, to make non-transgender people afraid of using the same bathroom. So we found corporate news coverage focused on these so-called bathroom bills and Trump's proposed transgender ban, but ignored a whole host of other important LGBT topics and issues. And so we found, as is probably no surprise to people who follow Project Censored and who listen regularly to Parallax Views, that the corporate news media is providing a fairly narrow range of perspective and opinion on issues when it comes to LGBT news coverage.
Well, I wanted to mention, I don't think we can get into these two chapters on this edition of the program, but there's two very good chapters that I think people should look at. Chapter 5, What's Burning, which is about, you know, basically crisis being turned into social media content. And Chapter 6, Kashmir Uncensored, Torture by the World's Largest Democracy. I highly recommend reading those. Briefly, I just wanted to get into two more things with you, if you can. First, you have the annual Media Democracy in Action chapter. I'm very glad to see Russ Kick, who has been doing really important work for years on media transparency and Freedom of Information Act requests. He is included in this edition of Project Censored 2020. Maybe you could talk a little bit about Media Democracy in Action and the contributors.
Yeah, this is a fantastic edition of our annual Media Democracy in Action chapter. And I got to give a shout out here to Steve Masick, who is the person at Project Censored who put the chapter together this year. So Steve just, you know, this year's lineup is fantastic. And it includes, as you say, not only Russ Kick, about whose work I'll say more in a moment, but also a fantastic chapter by Catherine Fox Hill, on who's with the Society of Professional Journalists, on how public information officers are more increasingly common, and they function effectively as censors at both governmental and corporate organizations across the country. We have Matthew Crane and Anthony Nadler talking about the Silicon Valley digital influence machine, very much in line with some of the things we've just been saying. We have contributors from DSmog blog talking about the fossil fuel industry and how it runs its PR campaigns. And we also have another thing I would point people to, and then I'll say some more about Russ Kick's section in this year's book and also his long-term contributions. We also are thrilled to feature Propaganda Critic, which is a website that engagingly educates members of the public about how to defend themselves from media manipulation and propaganda. And that sounds like, oh, you know, eat your broccoli, take your multivitamin. But Aaron DeWelsch, who's the founder and of Propaganda Critic, and Mary Margaret Herring, not only introduce it, but that I think anyone who goes to the Propaganda Critic website will see that, will be as impressed as I was when I looked at it. They revamped it recently. And it's always had great content in terms of the actual material, but what they've done is they've given it a whole new look. And visually, this is just like the website pops. Like, you get to the homepage and you want to just dive in. It looks so good. And then the nice thing is, this is one of those occasions where the appearance is indicative of the substance, right? It's really good. So about Russ Kick, who's of course the founder and manager of AltGov 2, and many people who have tracked his work will remember admiringly his Memory Hole website. Russ Kick has basically devoted himself to increasing government transparency. And what he's writing about in this year's book is basically it's just a brief report on his effort to change how the National Archives and Record Administration in Washington, D.C. works. This is the entity, NARA, the National Archives and Records Administration, is responsible for retaining government documents, federal government documents. So almost every federal agency has to abide by NARA's rules in terms of the retaining of records. What Russ found was that, you know, most all of these documents, some 97 to 99% of all federal government documents, are eventually shredded, wiped from hard drives, or otherwise destroyed. And there's great variability in the time frame for keeping documents. And for which documents, so what documents should be kept and for how long? And what Russ found, and this is in the Media Democracy in Action story, because it's a success story, or at least a partial success story, is that many times important documents were being shredded with no public notification that that was what was going to happen. I say shredded, but they might, you know, if they're on a hard drive, they're being erased. The documents are being destroyed. So he began trying to intervene in this process. And by simply doing what Russ has done for so long, he requested full proposal and appraisal records of these various decisions. I won't try to tell the whole story. It's much better in Russ's own direct first-person account. But basically, he has succeeded through persistent effort over months and months and months to get NARA to make some slight alterations in how it informs the public about what documents it's proposing to destroy, and how the public can and making those documents and that process more accessible to the public. So it's a great success story, I think.
Real quickly here, I'm just going to note to my listeners some of the top stories in the top 25. Underwater avalanches heighten risks of oil catastrophe. Trump administration threatens Endangered Species Act. U.S. women face prison sentences for miscarriages. There are so many stories in here. One of the ones that really stood out to me was number 7. Flawed investigations of sexual assaults in children's immigration shelters. And as a note, at least 3 of the stories deal with the growing problem of sexual abuse and modern slavery in America and around the world today. I'm glad to see Project Censored covering that. But this flawed investigations of sexual assaults in children's immigrant shelters, it's been hitting me pretty hard lately because, we live in this age where you have, all these people on social media talking about QAnon or, Jeffrey Epstein. And I think in the case of Epstein, that's a very real case that people should look into. I think QAnon's a bit of a wacky sort of, BS thing. But if you really cared about, sexual abuse, we have to look at things like what's going on in these migrant centers. And we have private prison companies like GEO Group and Core Civics now being, sued by migrants for activities going on in these detention centers. Mm-hmm. And I feel like not enough people are talking about it. So maybe you could comment on that specific story briefly.
Yeah, and we have this story because of some great reporting from ProPublica, which undertook a 6-month investigation of immigrant children's shelters. Shelters is probably a misnomer anyway, but it's especially so in terms of what they found at the end of that report. I'm using now the language of the ProPublica report by Michael Greibel, Topher Sanders, and Sylvina Sterin-Pencil. A largely hidden side of the shelters, one in which both staff and other residents sometimes acted as predators. And what they found was that again and again, police were quickly and with little investigation closing cases, often within days and even hours. There were startling lapses in how both federal and state authorities were investigating allegations of sexual assaults in these government institutions. Really what we're talking about, just very quickly and without diving too deep into more detail, we're talking about a horrific situation being made infinitely more so by the fact that when there is predation, when there are sexual assaults, there appears to be very little in the way of justice. And as ProPublica reported, this has to do with how these shelters, so-called, are set up. Right. So because immigrant children in detention are frequently moved, children are often moved out of an investigating agency's jurisdiction in just a few weeks, sometimes without warning, meaning that even if an investigator wanted to pursue a case, it would be more difficult to do so. This is the top 25 list includes a number of what I think are encouraging and good news stories this year, but number 7 on flawed investigations of sexual assaults in children's immigrant shelters is not one of those.
I think one of the more positive ones that touched me a little bit was the new programs make school food systems more equitable. That's number 23, folks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a great success story. So this is reporting from Yes Magazine, who's been a leader since the mid-90s in constructive journalism, serious news reporting that emphasizes not just problems but also solutions. School food programs, school meal programs, I shouldn't say simply lunch, although lunch is the main one, are big business in this country, right? $3 billion of corporate contracts. So this is an example, an exemplar of the kind of concentrated corporate wealth that impacts people's lives on a daily basis. But what this story is about is how there are alternatives and how in communities across the country, people are working to develop regional farm-to-school hubs. The farm-to-school hubs ultimately at the end provide really fresh and delicious meals to students. But along the way, they also are creating jobs for skilled employees who help process and produce the food, and they're also obviously sustaining the livelihood of community farmers. So the Community Coalition for Real Meals has been leading one of the leaders in this, as has the Food Revolution Network. This is a hopeful story. This is a story that not all the stories that people need to know more about are bad news stories. I think one of the most underreported sort of genres, if you will, of news in the corporate news media are constructive solutions, good news stories. And I think there's something to be said about that, which is that, you know, you kind of have to think about, well, why would corporate news media not want to regularly feature and highlight stories about communities coming together to solve the systemic problems that they face? These are stories ultimately about people power and community power. And of course, what's the greatest threat to sort of corporate hegemony? Well, it's people and community power, I think. So we're always happy at Project Censored to highlight positive news stories like our number three story, indigenous groups from the Amazon proposing to create the largest protected area on Earth. How humanitarian groups are promoting solutions to extreme violence in West Africa. And of course, this one we've just been talking about, how new programs are making school food systems more equitable.
It's very true. I think a lot of the good stories get shuffled off to the side, and sometimes the good in the bad stories gets shuffled to the side. I've been covering, Dallas-Fort Worth police corruption in light of the Amber Geiger shooting of Botham Jean, the off-duty cop who shot a black man in his own apartment, and also the similar shooting of a Tatiana Jefferson. And what I think gets ignored is that it was the activists and the citizens of those communities in Dallas and Fort Worth that have been, pushing to make this an issue and to say, we want justice done. You know, if it wasn't for them, I'm not sure the stories would have became national news. So there's always good things that we have to look out for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we need to function, and we actually have a chapter about this very topic in this year's Censored book. Ken Burroughs, Amber Yang, and Bethany Surface, the final chapter in this year's book is Our Collective Crisis in Constructive Journalism, Growing the Good and Possible. And what Ken, Amber, and Bethany propose is a kind of a tripod model of news media. The one of the legs is kind of traditional critical journalism, which is problem-focused journalism, but they also propose solutions journalism and constructive journalism as other elements of that tripod. And the idea is that we need, if we're going to be fully informed, we need not only critical journalism with its focus on problems, but we also need solutions journalism that focuses on innovation and highlights new ways of thinking. And we need engagement journalism that reminds us about that, you know, we can change systems by expanding the public commons. We can change mindsets through things like art and storytelling. And so the idea isn't that we don't need kind of conventional good muckraking investigative reporting. We surely do. But we also need news that will inspire us and lift us up and encourage us. And constructive journalism is, I think, you know, the increasingly popular sort of umbrella term for that sort of reporting.
Well, it's funny. I always like to say that I like to end the show on a positive note. I think we did that naturally. Real quick here, I want to get your thoughts. It's been, I think, a very precarious time for a lot of people looking to do good in journalism. Mm-hmm. We have places like Splinter and Deadspin, both which were owned by Geo Media Group. They've gone down. Journalists are very aggravated. They believe they're getting stonewalled. People are getting laid off at places like Vice. Mm-hmm. Do you think journalism is going to make it through all of this? I mean, it seems like a pretty precarious time, but I want to be hopeful that, you know, the journalists in our society today will make it through this difficult time.
Yeah, I mean, do we have a little more time to talk about those cases of Splinter and Deadspin? Is it okay if we dig
yes,
in on those
no,
a little
no
bit?
No problem. Yeah. I would love to talk about
okay.
it.
Okay, yeah, and then we can talk about, like, I think what, you know, in some ways, like, what should the response to that be as well? But just to kind of back it up for a minute, right, we have Splinter that was established in 2017, kind of as the replacement of Gawker. And I'll say more about that in a minute. And then Deadspin, which is even older, established 2005, right? And most people think of Deadspin, like, I guess, as sports, right? But the whole point, that thing that made Deadspin different, and please jump in here, JG, and fill in the spaces I'm leaving untouched. Right. Deadspin did sports, but they also did, you know, pop culture and media and politics. Right. And yeah, to backtrack, like, what happened at Deadspin was a bunch of them were given a directive, what, a week or two ago, I think, to basically stick to sports. Right. Don't write anything else political. And people who worked there didn't take that well, and there began to be what were in effect mass resignations. The Gizmodo Media Group union, which represents all the writers who work for the Geo Group, basically said they condemned the action and basically said that the mandate to stick to sports was basically a thinly veiled "do not speak truth to power" order. So similar things then at Splinter. I mentioned Gawker a moment ago. You know, Gawker was shut down in 2016, basically after Peter Thiel, the co-founder of PayPal, you know, sued.
Head of a huge surveillance, you know, tech company in the form of Palantir.
Yes, right, right. And you know, Gawker said things about him that he didn't like, so he wielded his influence, mobilized lawyers and got Gawker shut down. So Splinter was important, I think, as a kind of the heir to what Gawker had been doing. And it was ostensibly shut down due to insufficient traffic. And I think, you know, again, like, both of these entities were in one way or another providing alternatives to sort of establishment corporate view of the world, and then as you rightfully point out, we find them, they're both basically shuttered. There are no writers at Deadspin anymore, as far as I know now.
Well, it's interesting because you know, and I haven't seen this term used until this Deadspin story broke, but the term scab has now been coming into my news feed, and of course scab is an old term from the union days, when unions were a lot stronger in the U.S. You know, a scab would basically not join the unions. They would take work from the companies that the unions were fighting against. And you had a few scabs joining Deadspin. And there was so much outrage and outcry against them that some of these people who were going to work as scabs for Deadspin said, oh, I was wrong. Never mind. I'm on my way out. I'm not going to work for Deadspin. So, I mean, in a way, that's a victory. That's a symbol of resistance that we can sort of, you know, we can voice our minds on these things and say, hey, why are you working with the people who are trying to screw us over?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, you know, I think on these, first I would say it's important. I think scab isn't a totally outdated term, and I think where unions are still representing workers' interests, you know, that term and that concept are still very much in operation. But I think, you know, it's upsetting when you hear that a long-standing outlet like Deadspin, you know, Splinter, more, you know, longevity isn't the only thing, right? These were places employing journalists who are doing independent journalism. That's upsetting. But it's part of a larger pattern that we see. I would point people quickly, if I may, to a Mother Jones report from earlier this year, the cover story of the March-April 2019 issue of Mother Jones, which you can also find online, is called How Facebook Screwed Us All by Monica Bauerlein and Clara Jeffrey. And one of the features of this story is how another great independent news outlet was basically killed by, in this case, by Facebook's sort of the vagaries and shifting desires of leadership at Facebook. The news organization Mike, which had done some great reporting. We had featured a Mike story in the top 25 list a couple books ago, some of the best reporting that I've come across at the time and since on the murder of transgender people, the unaccountable murders of transgender people, and the scope of those murders was done by a reporter at Mike. Mike basically was driven out of business by Facebook, by Facebook's changing policies. And that's a loss. That's a real loss. And this Mother Jones article of How Facebook Screwed Us All sort of documents, it's sort of the anatomy. It covers a bigger array of topics, but it gives a kind of investigate the body after it's dead. It's an autopsy. It's an autopsy of what happened at Mike. Now, I don't know. I don't want to be heard as suggesting that somehow, you know, media giants like Facebook or Google are behind the Splinter and Deadspin thing. I just don't know enough about those, and I don't think we collectively know enough about what happened there. But when you hear that Splinter was shut down, that the Geo Media company said we're shutting this down due to insufficient traffic, knowing what we know about how algorithms work, about the power of these social media platforms to promote or to deplatform different things, and you know that Splinter is kind of the continuation of what happened at Gawker, you know, my antennas start to buzz a little bit. And that's a story, thanks in part to you, JG, who tipped me off on this, really. You know, that's a story I'm going to want to be tracking as it develops.
And I guess briefly here, you know, one of the big concerns I think a lot of journalists have been facing is, you know, there's been mass layoffs in the past year. I mean, Vice was the big one. I knew journalists who were laid off just at the last minute. And you know, what their situation was going to be like, they were completely caught off guard by it all. And apparently, you know, I mean, to me, that's a grave injustice because – you know, to leave people in that state of precarity is just heinous. And I think more and more we're seeing that happen, these layoffs, journalists just being in precarious situations. Do you think that that's going to change? Because I think it's radicalizing journalists a lot more. There's a lot more journalist unions. A lot of journalists are becoming very, very left-wing. I mean, I was reading Teen Vogue recently, and they have like left wing analysis of like anarchism and stuff now. I mean, it's so bizarre, but I think maybe the corporate media is pushing our journalists too far.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think again, like as with many of these things, you can look at it and see sort of a dim, dark future or the basis for something better, right? To kind of cycle back to some of those themes from Gilda Ochoa's poem. But yeah, in terms of journalist layoffs, I am always thinking of there was a 2011 FCC, Federal Communications Commission report that basically established that, quote, news adequacy in the U.S. would require about 50,000 reporters. So adequate coverage of the news But as Jessica Cohen reported in spring of this year in an Utney Reader article, today about 25,000 reporters have jobs. So by the FCC standards from a few years ago, we're at about 50% of what we need to have adequate news coverage in this country. Now, it's important to note that that estimate of 25,000 reporters doesn't include a lot of people who I think we at Project Censored would say ought to be counted. They may not be professional journalists, but they're engaging in news reporting and news and investigative reporting. So I think that figure of 25,000 may be a little of an undercount, because it's focused on these kind of legacy and corporate entities, and it's not taking into account the how robust independent journalism in the U.S. is today. But that doesn't mean that there isn't still probably a pretty considerable gap to the amount of people doing journalism that we need to be well informed. So I think there is a kind of a simple quantitative angle to the problem. We need more people doing good journalism. But there's also, I think, a qualitative angle, right? We need more people doing good journalism. And so again, I come back to, you know, one of the core kind of ideas of Project Censored is to get a wider public aware that there are high quality alternatives to the network evening news or even the cable evening news, right? There are high quality alternatives to the networks and MSNBC and Fox and Breitbart and whatever. But again, I think in terms of food metaphors, I think of it as kind of like, well, yeah, there's the fast food chain has its place on the corner and its giant advertising budget. And you know, you can go in there and get like, a 2,000 calories for $3 or $4, and so it's easy, and at some level it's quickly tasty, but it'll, you know, that'll wreck your health if you eat there regularly. And the alternative, which I think of being like the independent news media, is more like the farmer's market, right? It takes a little more effort. It doesn't have a giant advertising budget. It's not all over the evening news as, promoting, hey, you know, shop here for fresh produce. But if you eat there regularly, one, you'll get to know the people who actually produce your food, and you'll probably eat healthier, and you may be surprised to find that it doesn't actually cost that much more. And I feel like that's the truth for independent news media. It's out there. And part of the challenge is to just get people to be aware that it's out there, and that, you know, I say to my students all the time, look, it's not my job to tell you what or who to listen to when it comes to news. But what I'd like to do is challenge you, say, for the next 2 weeks of this semester, listen to things different than what you're used to. And especially if you're used to listening to corporate things of one corporate content of one sort or another, add some independent news content to your quote news diet, and see if 2 weeks from now you don't feel differently. And you know what I find is students come back and say, "Oh yeah, Roth, I've been you know, I made Yes Magazine online my homepage, right? Or you know, I added them to my social media stream," and it's like, "Wow, I had no idea, man." And yeah, that gives me hope.
Well, the only thing I would add to that is you know, I think the fear is that, what if they go to the bad alternative news websites, like, say a wild website like the Goldwater, which is run by this guy, Jim Watkins, who he's the big promoter of the QAnon nonsense. And I'm like, but, you know, the thing is, I think most people aren't going to go to that website. I honestly think most people are going to go to Yes Magazine or Counterpunch or Project Censored. Right. Maybe we should have more faith in people and their ability to have new media literacy.
Well, depending on the day, I have more or less faith in people's good judgment. But every day I'm into the idea of teaching people how to – it's not just where you go, but what you do with the news that you get when you – the news that you find when you get there. And so I'm a big believer. I mean, this is another major theme of Project Censored's work. It's all about critical media literacy. It's about giving people the tools they need to assess for themselves, is this story trustworthy? Should I, you know, is it trustworthy enough for me to believe it? Is it of sufficient quality that I ought to, post it or repost it, right?
Regardless of whether it's a legacy media outlet, an alternative media
exactly.
outlet, yeah.
And so if you don't have critical media literacy skills, you're making those determinations on what? The rhetoric and appeal of the author, the perceived authority of the source. Oh, it was in the Washington Post, so it must be reliable. So we try to, what we're doing in our classrooms and what I think the book kind of condenses into, a 5x8-inch format that you can carry around with you is sort of like a toolkit for how to do this, right? So I'll talk to my students all the time. I think you don't have to have a fancy computer or access to any online databases that you need to be on a university campus to be able to access. Pick any news story you want to look at on any topic you're concerned with, and just look at who's quoted, who's treated as having opinions and perspective worth quoting directly, and look at how those people are identified. This to me is like media literacy 101. So you look at that and you look at the pattern of that across the whole article or across the whole front page or whatever the unit is of analysis is. And when you do that, what you'll find by and large when you look in the corporate news media is almost everyone who's quoted is a bureaucratic official of some type or another. They're either a government official or a corporate official by and large. And I've published studies with students where we look at some of the notable exceptions to those patterns when it comes to corporate news media. But by and large, that pattern holds. And where it doesn't hold, it holds in ways that kind of, in some sense, prove the rule. If, by contrast, you begin looking at a lot of independent news media, you'll still find probably that officials are quoted. But what you'll also find is that a much wider diversity of people are deemed newsworthy by independent journalists and independent news outlets. And that diversity of perspective will be manifest in who's quoted directly. And I'll give just one kind of concrete example of this. I mentioned that, Facebook has this new Facebook News initiative that's going to be a partnership between it and these big legacy media outlets like the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post. If you go back and look at the New York Times's coverage of this, this partnership, which this article ran on October 26th in the business section of the print paper. Every person who's quoted in this article about this merger, or not a merger, I apologize, about this partnership is a corporate official. So it's Zuckerberg from Facebook itself. It's I'm just going to run through here, but while I'm doing it, my cat is jumping on the computer. It's Robert Thompson, the chief executive of News Corporation. It's the chief executive and chief operating officer of The Times. It's Campbell Brown, who will be the leader of this organization, who will be the leader of this not organization, this project, the Facebook News. Campbell Brown is quoted. Well, Campbell Brown, before they became the new leader of Facebook News, was a TV journalist for NBC and CNN. There is no dissenting viewpoint in the New York Times coverage of this new partnership, except for one. The reporters, I guess out of some sense of journalistic objectivity and balance, went to the trouble of they found a tweet from Sleeping Giants, which is a digital news watchdog that monitors advertisers. And they found a tweet that expressed some concern about this partnership between Facebook and these giant media news media outlets. But otherwise, the entire article was told from the point of view of corporate officials involved in the partnership itself. So that's an echo chamber too, right? So I think, that's one example of what I think anyone can do on any story of whatever topic they're interested in. Look at who's quoted directly, look at how they're described, and then thinking about the article as a whole, ask, do the quoted sources represent a diverse range of opinion on this issue? And if they do, you might have a fairly strong news article. one that would you could conclude was reasonably reliable and maybe worth, you know, forwarding on to your mother or your brother or whoever you forward things to via your social media. But if you don't, if you conclude this is a fairly narrow range of sources and therefore a fairly narrow range of perspective, maybe it is better to look to other sources for a full understanding of that topic or that issue.
Well, I want to thank you again, Andy Lee Roth, for coming on Parallax Views and staying with us for a little bit longer. I honestly like doing these more long-form episodes, going maybe, you know, 80, 90 minutes. So I appreciate your staying on a little bit extra. I think we sort of ended on a positive note there, which I always like to do at the end of the show. Maybe, though, you could tell my listeners how they could get a hold of Censored 2020 through the Looking Glass, and any other positive vibes you want to give out there to my listeners, throw them out there now if you can.
Thanks so much, JG. Yeah, you can order the book directly from Project Censored ourselves by going to projectcensored.org. And you'll find fairly prominently up there a link that will take you to a place where you can buy it directly from us. You can get it directly from our wonderful independent book publisher, Seven Stories Press, based in New York. And of course, we'd be happy to have you ask for it at your favorite local independent bookshop, too. And I think that the positive thing I would end on is to say first about us and then more generally that, you know, Project Censored are how we work is, you know, we do a lot with a little in terms of finances and book sales, especially direct book sales, help us continue to do what we do to fund the programs that we put on. So things like the weekly radio show, the campus affiliates program, indeed, you know, the writing of the book. But we know we're not alone in that regard, right? Project Censored is part of this fantastic networked news commons of independent news organizations and outlets. It's an informal network. It's not an official thing. It's not an association or whatever. But all those independent news outlets that you know and like, including the Parallax Views podcast, could probably use your support, your financial support. I know at Project Censored, people signing up to become monthly subscribers, giving as little as $5 a month, which is, as our webmaster says, the cost of a hipster cup of coffee. That makes a huge difference to us. And I expect, you know, it doesn't have to be Project Censored. Think about the independent news outlets that you appreciate and consider the possibility, if it's within your means, of signing up to donate $5 a month. That makes a difference. And I think, you know, we talk a lot about providing support for independent news organizations, independent journalists, and there's all kinds of ways to provide support. But one basic one is, like, everyone needs to pay the bills, and that's important. So I would say support independent news media where you find it. Support the outlets that provide you what you can't get anywhere else.
Well, thank you again, Andy Lee Roth of Project Censored, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thanks. It's my pleasure, JG.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Andy Lee Roth, Associate Director of Project Censored, and that you'll consider picking up Censored 2020 Through the Looking Glass. Available now from Seven Stories Press. Also, be sure to head over to projectcensored.org to keep up with the great work Project Censored is doing. Want to drop me a line about this episode? Give me your thoughts? You can do so at viewsparallax on Twitter or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Also, you can support me on Patreon. A little bit behind on the bonus content this week. There was a problem recording the Parallax Views current events program the week that was. But I should have some goodies out this week anyways. So stay tuned for that if you're a Parallax Views Patreon supporter. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.